when things get really hard with creating, mm-hmm. something that's special to be able to turn to is like, this is bigger than me, mm-hmm. you know?
Hi, I'm Ebony, and I believe that stories change lives, and everyone has a story worth telling. Sometimes, unfortunately, we let our self-doubt get in the way of us writing our stories and sharing our stories. So that's why I created Motivation to Write as a source of motivation and inspiration to help writers like you and me share our stories with the world. So I talk to the experts ranging from entrepreneurs to marketers to authors to therapists to psychologists who share their knowledge and their advice to help writers like you and me step into our full potential.
Kaylee Roberts is an author and producer who tells women's stories. As a storyteller, Kaylee Roberts enjoys researching, discovering, and sharing narratives that are traditionally marginalized. Sharing these stories, she believes, is a powerful way to teach empathy. Kaylee has worked on HBO and Netflix productions, including Fuller House and Britney vs. Spears. In 2021, she published Unreported, which explores the question, why doesn't anyone report sexual violence?
Kaylee Roberts, I'm so happy to have a conversation with you because you are an... Did you publish your book yet?
Yeah, I have a big stack.
Okay. Okay, so I'm trying to see. Can I see the cover?
Here it is, in the flesh.
Okay, so Unreported. Okay, yes. And I know that you write a lot about sexual assault, women specifically in sexual assault, right? Okay, sexual violence. So I want to know, first tell us a little bit about your path to writing. When did that start?
Sure, yeah. I know that's what stood out to me about your podcast is it's so author-centric and entrepreneur-centric. I've always wanted to be a writer since I was a very, very little girl. I always say, like, I have two younger sisters and they'd be playing sports outside and I would just look and be like, I would so much rather be in here writing a short story or whatever I was working on at age 7, you know? Right. So I think for a long time I knew I wanted to write a book and I wanted to write it as a young person, but then as I'm sure you've experienced and a lot of people experience, you know, you're a woman in your 20s and it feels like you're unqualified, right? For a lot of things. And, starting out in a career field, it's just a time where I think a lot of the messaging from the outside world is a bit like, wait your turn, you know, pay your dues. You don't really know anything yet. I wanted to write a book and I had the idea for Unreported actually for about 6 years before I wrote it. Mm-hmm. And then finally I found this professor at Georgetown who got the opportunity to write a book in his 20s and he really helped. He brought me into a community of authors who are also young people, hooked me up with the publishing company, mm-hmm. The publisher. And he was like, trust me, anyone can write a book. You don't have to be 40. You don't have to be, you know, peak in your field. It was a great experience.
That's a lovely story because I think a lot of when you're a kid and you say something like, I want to be a writer, I want to be an artist, I want to be, I want to be an actor. People usually, especially if you are a girl, people usually just kind of poo-poo that. Like, oh, really? Like, how are you going to make money out of that? That's not a real career. But usually when you have those instincts as a young person, as a child, that's a clue. I was just talking to someone before I was talking to you. That's a clue that that is something that's going to reemerge in your adulthood. You know, if you ditched it as a kid or was beaten out of you as a kid, it's going to reemerge. And that could be a clue as to like your pathway, career-wise, job-wise, whatever, as an adult. And it sounds like that is how it worked out for you.
Totally. Isn't it so cool as artists how we have this higher power in us that's saying, okay, this is you. Like, you know, you are meant to create in this way or that way. I think that's something that I have friends who are artists too in various fields, musicians, filmmakers, obviously. And I just think there is this sense of I was put on earth to do this. And it's so special to really honor that and pursue it.
Yeah. So Kaylee, what were you writing as a kid? What kind of stuff did you enjoy writing as a kid?
I wrote everything. I wrote plays that I would perform in my driveway with my neighbors, who I gave them costumes. I'm very bossy kid, oldest child, classic. So I write a lot of plays. I write short stories. I would write, you know, I'd think, oh my gosh, I'm a 12-year-old kid. I'm writing a novel and I'm going to be, you know, a prodigy. I'm going to publish this as a 13-year-old. And that happened.
But there wasn't, I remember maybe this was, I want to say maybe 10 years ago, maybe not so long ago. Yeah, maybe about 10 years ago. But there was this like 12-year-old, I think he was 11 or 12-year-old, who wrote a book on how to talk to girls. Do you remember this book? He was in the news, and I saw his book in the bookstore, like how to talk to girls, and he was 11 years old. But anyways, it can happen.
So refreshing. And circle back like to our point that we were talking about before, like, I'm sure he had great advice. The things kids think are really relevant to all of life. I mean, I think we discount them a bit, but it's like they just see things so simply. And sometimes as adults, we get a little wound up. So,
Okay. So then you mentioned that you had the idea for your book about 6 years before you actually started writing it, or 6 years before it was published?
About 6 years before I started writing it, when I was, well, about 5 years before I started writing it. So I had the idea when I was 19, and I didn't know at first when I conceived it, like, or when it came to me, like, if I was going to do it as like for some reason I thought maybe it would be a good docu-series. Mm-hmm. And then when I was in college for a class, I like pitched that to my, one of my television, cause I got a degree in film and TV at Boston University. So I pitched the docu-series idea to one of my TV teachers, and, she was like, I don't think you're ready. I mean, it's sexual assault, right? So it is a huge topic. And even when I was writing the book, finally at 24, when I started, now I'm 26. And when I started, I still felt unqualified to tackle such a big topic. I mean, I did so much research. It was like all I could think about, all I could, read about for so long. And I talked to so many different experts and advocates and just people. And I still felt like there is no way I will ever be able to speak for everyone who's had an experience like this.
So, yeah, because at the age of 19, why was this such a compelling issue for you?
Yeah, so it's a compelling issue for me because, well, and I write about this in a chapter of the book, because the book is, I spoke to many people, but I ended up incorporating like 6 different stories of women who actually did experience sexual violence and then didn't report. And so I incorporate their stories, and then part of it is research based. So I do their story, and then I do a research component where I research a person who did report and contrast the two. And then I also have my own thread in there, because my story is that I went to college at Boston University, and, I grew up in this tiny town with all women. I was literally raised by women, plus my dad, but like my grandmas were around, my aunt, like so many aunts, and my sisters and my mom, and then my dad. But yeah, so yeah, he was there. But, when I went to college, there was just this contrast where I remember walking down the streets of Boston and reading these news alerts and being exposed to, like, thinking about news in a different way, and as you do when you go to college, and realizing that the way that I was valued, which is so lucky, as a woman when I was growing up seemed so different than the way that the world valued women. And I was reading specifically all these pieces, these headlines and articles that were like about, yeah, women being raped and then reporting and their case going nowhere, and men getting out of jail after raping a 14-year-old. And it was just, it was, and then perhaps most staggeringly, this story has really stuck with me. Emma Sulkowitz at Columbia, she was the girl who was raped her freshman year, raised it with Columbia. They did nothing. Raised it with the NYPD. They did nothing. Filed a Title IX suit against Columbia finally. So basically raised it with the government, and still didn't get what she wanted, which was just her assailant to be removed from campus. So what she ended up doing her entire senior year was carrying a twin XL sized mattress on her back everywhere she went. So I remember watching that case evolve. And then of course, as the universe would have it, I was then sexually assaulted the summer after my freshman year of college. Mm. So I felt like I had been watching this issue and really engaging with it on an intellectual level, and then all of a sudden I had to engage with it on an emotional level too.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I just want to go back to the young lady that was carrying the mat. She was literally carrying a mattress on her back for what, protection or?
Oh no! So it was actually so she's an artist.
Okay.
And it was a performance art piece, and I was struck by the way she, you know, raised this issue with the school, raised it with the NYP, tried the government, like raised all, or she did like the media tour, you know, with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, and none of those things had the outcome she wanted. So she eventually turned to art.
Okay. Yeah.
Art, but it didn't either. So yeah.
Well, walking around with a mattress strapped to your back will get someone's attention.
It got a lot of attention.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, okay. And did they ever, whatever came of that, did they ever, did the assailant ever get kicked off campus?
She walked across the stage at her graduation with the mattress on her back.
Wow. Okay. Wow. Okay. Yeah. And so then you had your own experience with sexual assault. What year in college was this for you? You said you were...
Right after my freshman year.
Right after your freshman year. So that kind of, that, so you had been hearing about sexual assaults in the news on college campuses also, and then you have your own. So then how, I mean, I don't know how much detail you want to go into, but how did your assailant face any
repercussions?
Yes, repercussions. Like reprecations. That doesn't even work. Repercussions?
Yeah. Yeah, no, so that actually was kind of the genesis for the book, because it happened to me, and then I was, you know, before I was like, what's going on here? I'm reading all these articles, and it happened to me. I was like, oh, that's what's going on. Okay. And so then what I ended up, you know, doing was not reporting, because I felt like I had almost been, I felt that the news articles I'd watched were almost like a warning to me. Like, I was like, I've been watching this issue so closely, and it seems like it never works out for anyone. And, you know, I had all these gut instincts, which each chapter of the book explores a reason that people don't report. And the ultimate goal of the book is to basically lay out a blueprint of why people aren't reporting, because sexual assault and sexual violence is actually the most underreported crime more than anything else. Mm-hmm. You know, on the, there's a bunch of different statistics. Obviously it's a hard thing to track, but on the low end, 75% of people don't report. On the high end, 95% of people don't report. Mm-hmm. So it's really unreported. And so, I mean, I just feel that law enforcement needs a blueprint of here's why people don't report. And then they can make us, so we need to make a system that people would then report into, you know, knowing what the barriers to entry are for people and how it's not accessible. Then let's create a system that people want to use, because eventually the only way to truly solve sexual violence or to make an impact and lessen the issue is to have people report. Like, the law enforcement needs to know who to go after, right? And that was a point that was raised to me by an ex-boyfriend, and that was kind of what got me thinking, like, there was no world in which I wanted to report mine. But obviously that's inherently an issue.
Yeah. Okay. I think we should define sexual assault.
Sure.
So how do you define sexual assault?
That's great. So in the book, I actually use the term sexual violence, and I'm sorry if I've been using the term sexual assault. It's so confusing to know what to call it. But the instances I write about in the book and the ones that I am aiming to solve are the ones where consent or sex is disregarded. So, you know, I have struggled personally to use the word rape because I feel like it's a loud word. And, you know, I feel like there is such a range with rape.
Okay. So I wanted to make that, I wanted you to define that, because we're not just talking about sexual harassment. So you're actually talking about like a intercourse of some kind or some type of something sexual. Maybe not even intercourse, but something sexual that was not, you did not give your consent for that sexual interaction. Okay. So how do you even begin? So then you have your own experience with sexual assault. And so then you start to ponder why women are not moving forward or not, you know, taking this to the authorities. Why didn't you take it to the authorities?
There are so many reasons, and it's such a myriad of reasons. And the book does break it down by chapter of, you know, per reason. Each chapter is a different reason.
Yeah.
But even when I interviewed other people, really everyone has multiple reasons. I think some of the big ones are, well, they're all fear-based. One of them is fear of, repercussions in your career. So fear of it affecting your career. One of them is, for me personally, I, and a lot of women I spoke to felt the same way, guilt, actually, not wanting to punish the assailant, in a way that we can't control, right? Like, I didn't want to hand it over and then have the police decide how to punish the person, because, you know, I knew how much it affected me, and I wouldn't have wanted his career and life to be wrecked. And I think that's a fairly common thing, especially as women. Fear of telling family, especially for men, that's a big one. For men who have been assaulted or experienced sexual violence, that's a big one. Mm-hmm. Or if you've experienced sexual violence within your family, that's a big one. Uh-huh. Telling the other family members.
Yeah.
And what are some other ones? Oh, well, the final reason that I write about is nothing will happen anyway. Like, the system doesn't work anyway.
Okay.
Which is backed up by a lot of stats. Rarely ever is someone actually convicted for sexual assault or violent or rape when it's reported. So that, I think, is a driving reason for sure.
And is there a fear of, like, no one's going to believe me?
Yeah, definitely. And that starts from the second you sit down with the person you're reporting to, right? And I mean, I think for a lot of women, you know, or people who experience this, you try it out by first telling your friends, telling whoever in your family you're comfortable telling, and then, you know, working up the courage to know, yes, this is real. Yes, this is bad, you know, because you do need that validation, especially if it happens to you as a young person, which it does for so many people. I mean, some of the people in the book were 15, 16, you barely know your opinion on anything at that age, you know?
Right.
So it's hard to know. The first person I called, I said the situation, and I said, so what do you think? And she said, yeah, that's rape. And I was like, okay, you know? So I think that's fairly common. And unfortunately, law enforcement isn't always educated on start by believing, on, you know, how to make someone feel safe when they have just felt so unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that as the years progress, it's becoming a little bit more sexual assault in women. It's becoming a little bit more credible of a topic with people, right? I think we were having this conversation like 30 years ago. I mean, who would care? I mean, I think that this stuff was so common that it was kind of expected for men to act a particular way. And if they went a little too far with it, then it was usually blamed on, you know, the women. You were being too loose, or you were being too suggestive, or whatever. But I think, you know, through history, through the women's rights movement and all the civil rights, I think that this has now become something in which we recognize that it isn't right for anyone of any gender to assert some type of unwanted sexual power over someone and think that, you know, they can just get away with it. It's you know, taking on a little bit more, there's more credence.
Totally more credence and just more respect for people who have gone through that, I think. And the start by believing saying is something that's big in the advocacy world and is just so huge. So I'm happy that's kind of, that's, I think, around, and people know that if someone sits down with you and says, this is my experience, that's how you're supposed to respond. You know, like, just start by believing and we can go from there.
Yeah.
But it's hard because that's inherently like juxtaposed to law enforcement. So.
Yeah. And so was this writing this book like a therapy?
Yeah. So a lot of people ask that. I think actually since it happened, I wrote it 5 years after it happened. I moved to California, as we were talking about when we first hopped on. Like, I like finished up my career at BU, and then went out to California and worked and spent a lot of time in the Pacific Ocean, at the beach, you know, going to therapy. And I feel like I did a lot of healing then. And actually, by the time I wrote it, I feel like, so one of the people I interviewed for the book, it was so interesting. A therapist told me about the sixth stage of grief. So, mm-hmm. you know, you go through all those classic five stages, anger, and then working your way up to acceptance, yeah. depression, whatever else is in there. But the sixth phase, which is new, is meaning making. And so
meaning making. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I feel like I had pretty much healed. You know, I was in acceptance. I was there. It's, you know, I knew the stats, which, you know, 1 in 5 for women. And as high as 1 in 6 for men. So basically, like, this happens to a lot of people. And yeah. So I had gone to the acceptance phase, and then when this like beautiful opportunity to actually write with a community around me and with an encouragement from this professor came along, it was actually almost I was a bit hesitant to finally do it. I was like, oh, I'm done. Like, I processed that, it's done. And I didn't even want to go back to it, but kind of deep down in my gut, I knew that if I was going to write a book about anything, this is the most valuable thing that I could write about. Like, this would be the most valuable contribution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know on this podcast, you talk about motivation to write, right? Like, finding motivation. And I think something that really helped me was having a way to make it about other people too. Mm-hmm. You know, like writing a fiction book, I don't know if I actually would have ever finished. Like, I think just the sometimes, because as you know, as an artist, like, when things get really hard with creating, mm-hmm. something that's special to be able to turn to is like, this is bigger than me, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that was good. But it was definitely a meaning-making experience for sure.
Yeah. And you said, how many women did you interview?
So I interviewed about like 15 women. 15. But about 6 made the book. Yeah.
About 6 for the book. Also, you interviewed total 15, and 6 of their stories are included in the book.
Yeah.
What were the age ranges for these women?
So it was largely pretty young. They were actually all under 30. And it was important to me to, for this book, writing it as a 25-year-old, it was important to me to keep the voices pretty young in the book, because I wanted to, in a way, you know, I've been so inspired by other fellow female writers who are younger. And had like that audacity to be like, I know everyone thinks I know nothing, but I'm going to publish a book of my words.
Yeah.
So I was really inspired by like my boss, Erin Lee Carr, who wrote a memoir at like 27. You know, I love, I don't remember the name of it right now. Mm-hmm. But this other book, I'll email that to you.
It'll come when you least expect it to come.
Yeah, it'll come. So I wanted to, like, my voice was going to be in it, and I didn't plan that at the beginning, but once it was settled that my voice was going to be in it with my editor and everything, and my story, I then was like, I want it to be not just me telling my story, but I want it to be a bunch of people around this age telling their story, because I want to talk about what's currently happening with sexual violence, what the situations that people get into that they are not reporting look like right now. And in terms of, I interviewed a lot of like older advocates and people who like a female detective, which was pretty dope. Mm. And this woman who teaches at Columbia actually, journalism. And she has written a lot of books about rape and sexual violence. She wrote them like more in like the 70s through 90s. Yeah. So I did get that older perspective in that way, but mostly in the book, it's under 30. Mm-hmm. And it's all anonymous, so their stories are totally anonymized, and I worked heavily with them. Like, I sent them drafts and was like, what should I change? You know, we went back and forth 10 times sometimes.
Okay. Yeah. With the storyteller, not storytellers, but the women you were interviewing, you actually went back and forth with them.
Yeah, because I mean, it's a book about consent, and so I was like, you know, my editors were like, they consented to be in the book when they did the interview. And I was like, okay, but we're talking about literally consent being broken here. So I wanted to make sure that they were okay with every single word in their story as it was published.
Yeah. And what did you learn most about yourself when you were writing this?
Great question. I think I learned about a lot of things. One thing I learned was how powerful community is for me. I really think that, you know, I had an editor with me every step of the way writing this book. I had someone who was helping me develop it and like conceptualize how to break up the chapters and how to structure and yada yada. And then I had this other editor who went through revisions with me, like a really long revision process. And actually she would be fine with me telling you this, is one of the women whose story is in the book, coincidentally. So yeah, I think in terms of writing, I realized that like it is a solo sport, but if there is a way to make it a team effort, for me, that really worked. And it was cool to collaborate with mostly all women too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I can imagine that it took a lot of vulnerability for all stories to be shared. And was there a fear of public response, particularly from family, reading this? Did you have any, you know, trepidations?
Yeah, totally. So the women whose stories are in there who are anonymized, they had different levels of wanting to be anonymized. Like some of them were like, I really don't want my parents to read this and know it's me. So we changed like a lot. And then some of them though, one of them said to me, you know, Kaylee, I'm really excited for this book to come out because I'm going to give it to my mom and tell her, hey, that character is me.
Yeah.
And so that's how I'm going to tell her that this happened to me.
Were you scared at any point of what people would think about you and your story?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. That's why when I first conceptualized this, I was like, my story is not going to be in a book. And it just was too centered. Like I'm so invested in this partially because it happened to me. So I had to include it to be genuine and authentic. But yeah, I mean, I sat my parents down, like a year or 9 months before it came out. And once I had the first draft of the manuscript done, and I was like, hey guys, I just want to, you know, cause I had never shared it with them.
So the first they've heard of it when you actually, after you had written it, really not published, but written it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was like, just so you know, I'm going to be sending around this manuscript and, here's what you can expect. So yeah, I mean, that was a lot. It was a big day for us as a family, but we've definitely come really far since then. And personally, like I have two younger sisters and a younger female cousin. Like I was telling you, my family's really woman-centric, and I've loved watching us as a unit evolve into talking about this issue in a way more open and almost like matter-of-fact way, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that because what I'm hearing a lot just from what you're saying, other women were saying, and even and some of what you said, there's so much shame around it. And the sexual assault extends, I think, to molestation, child molestation, right? And this is something that a lot of families don't talk about, and it's really tragic when you're a kid and this has happened to you and you're shamed as a kid and you're kind of carrying this burden, because I think this is true of a lot of men and women, you know, sexually assaulted by an adult when you were a child, and you're still kind of carrying that burden. But I think that if people could learn how to use tools like you used writing, and you know, you don't have to publish a book about what you did, right? But I think that even journaling or you know, free writing, whatever, just to kind of get it out on paper just helps to validate your experience, because yes, a lot of people will never say anything to anyone about it, right? Yeah. So if you just even just write it privately for yourself, that can offer some type of relief and a path toward healing.
Totally. And there's something, so, I mean, do you journal?
Yes.
Yeah. So I recently started journaling in a more like regular way. And I think there's something so powerful about writing your experience down, and you don't need to share it anywhere. But like, you know, then you can flip back. Every time I sit down to write, I'm like, ooh, let's read an old entry too, because it's just something so validating about documenting your human experience, and then documenting not only like you're inherently going to document your growth, and if you are experiencing something like molestation or something like that, then you are documenting your healing, which is really powerful. But yeah, there's a part of my book, one of the people I researched, who I share his story and analyze it a bit, is Phil Saviano, who was he's actually a character in the movie Spotlight, So he was molested as an 11-year-old boy by someone in his church in Boston, which is a bit of, you know, and the Spotlight team broke open that story when Phil was probably like 30 or 40. It was pretty far removed. But I remember when I read his story, you know, and I watched Spotlight and everything, so interesting. And I think he turned to the advocacy world as a way to kind of process and make meaning out of what had happened to him, right? He was a huge advocate. He started the Boston chapter of like survivors of sexual assault by priests. There's a specific group for that. But I remember reading his story and watching it, and I was like, there's something else going on here. And he's actually in the chapter that talks about being not reporting because you're afraid to tell your family. As a man, and he's a gay man, in Boston, in New England, you know, very conservative culture, he did not tell his dad and his brothers for a long time because of the fear of how will they react? How will they shame me? I mean, I'm already gay, and that was a big thing for him to tell them. And he had AIDS at one point, so that was a big thing for him to tell them. And so he did talk about in one article that I finally found, telling his dad, and just like his dad's response being much more in the vein of, you should have never told anyone about this. Like, this should have been a family secret. Because he had already told the Boston Globe about it at that point. And his dad was just really upset with him, instead of kind of meeting it with grace and, you know, support. It was a bit more rough. So I think that's why people avoid that.
I wonder why, and maybe since you've talked to people, maybe you have some insight. Why do people, family, friends, shame others for having been sexually assaulted? Because I think it has to do a lot with, there's something that their experience or their story has triggered within them. And that gets very uncomfortable and scary. So it could be that hearing their story, perhaps they feel there might be some sense of like guilt. I should have been able to protect him, or it's my fault that he turned out, you know, if he's gay and parents, he turned out this way, but, you know. And so what did you notice anything about people's reaction that gives some insight as to why they react that way?
Yeah. Okay. Two answers here. So one, I have noticed since the book's been published, which has been super interesting, that men have the most intense reaction to it. They are the most emotional when they read it. They are the most scared to read it. You know, a few of my male friends and family have been like, I didn't really want to read it, you know? And I have been wondering the same thing as you. Why is this a male thing? Why is the pattern? I think it's because they are nervous about seeing themselves reflected in some capacity, in a way that they don't feel comfortable with, you know? And I, not to say that anyone in my life necessarily has committed this act, because it's actually not that many people. There's a statistic that shows that not that many men actually do commit sexual violence. It's just the ones that do do it repeatedly. But yeah, so that's been interesting. And then my second part of the second part of the answer is, did you watch Allen vs. Pharaoh on HBO?
No. What is it called?
It's called Allen v. Pharaoh, and it's a docuseries.
Woody Allen. No, I've been wanting to watch that, but I haven't seen it.
You should. It's so good. And there's this part in it, because, you know, Woody Allen in the 90s was – everyone kind of just got behind him for some reason. Like, people just did not stop supporting him, despite all of the evidence that he was a child molester and, you know, married his former – daughter. But anyways, in that docuseries, they say that the reason that people supported him is because, and this is often the reason people stand by, specifically people who commit child molestation within a family. It is so scary to think that someone could do that, that we as humans want to protect ourselves. So we default to, well, that couldn't be true. Mm-hmm. And we default to, that couldn't actually have happened. And I think in our desire to protect ourselves and protect our own feelings, we do project that to the person who's telling the story. Mm-hmm. And it's not like we're trying to make them feel ashamed. But in saying, hey, your story can't possibly be true, obviously that inflicts shame on the person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, I think that, it, you know, sexual assault might be so much more pervasive than we think, yeah. Right? And so it might also be that if you share this with someone, they've had their own experience with sexual assault that they would rather not talk about or share. And so that can trigger a particular response that, you know, comes across as being English. I can't talk today. What is wrong with me? Comes across as being angry or judgmental or whatever it is. But a lot of it, I think, is, as we were saying, there was this fear of challenging the fear that we have of sexual assault, fear of challenging the shame that we experience or fear that we might experience of sexual assault. And then projecting those fears onto other people who have the courage to break through that fear and say something. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, the female detective I spoke to said that within law enforcement, even, there's such a desire to not believe the reporter because there's this kind of feeling of, wow, this could wreck this person's life if this is true. And there is this camaraderie kind of where it's like, well, you know, I had a buddy who this happened to, and what if it's a false accusation? Then we're going to wreck this guy's life for nothing. And I don't know. So that's a factor too, the false reporting, which is actually really small. No one false reports.
2%. It takes a lot of courage. I don't know if people really realize how much courage it takes, especially to go up against someone who is publicly very popular. It takes a lot of courage to come and say something about that because you already know that people are going to hate you and you're going to be receiving a whole bunch of hate mail and tweets and whatever. So this is not something I think people just do frivolously, like, oh, let me just accuse this person. Like that's a heavy load that you are carrying. Mm-hmm. To bring out publicly that someone has done this to you, especially when they're an icon.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Totally.
I was talking to a friend recently about the Michael Jackson scandal from a few years ago. And they're, you know, Michael Jackson fans completely incredulous, right? Like, no way, there's no way this could happen. And then there was this article. And then that documentary came out, I think it was also HBO, about him and his accusers. So there was an article published, I can't remember in what paper, but it said there was this one line about the Michael Jackson case, and it said something like, people just have a difficult time accepting or seeing the con within the icon, right? Because we see all of the we identify this person as being what they do, right? So he's a great actor, he's a great director, he's a great singer, and that's just all, you know, it's all good, but it's not truly who that person is. It's kind of a smokescreen sometimes for exactly who they are. And we just kind of, what is the word? We make their profession, their accolades, their art interchangeable with their actual person, right? So, yeah, and if it's someone in your family who is idolized, who has done something to you, or even a friend or boyfriend who's idolized, that can be.
And it's scary. It's scary enough to conceptualize that this could happen with anyone, but how scary is it to like to realize that this person that you idolized in any capacity has an evil side? I mean, that's always scary to think about. So I think if there is a way to not think about that, or a way out, you know, of believing that, people take it.
Is there any advice you would give to someone who has experienced some type of sexual assault and wants to share, but they're scared of sharing, or is having a difficult time processing what has happened to them? Or
You know, my editor and I talked about this a lot, because when I was interviewing her for her chapter and everything, too, we were discussing the power of detachment in a way, for me and for her, and I think for many people, there is a lot of power in being able to remove yourself from the situation, just in the sense of reminding yourself, 1 in 5, right? 20% chance. Like, this is not a reflection of me. This is not a reflection of, you know, how I chose to live my life that day or night or for that span of time, whatever happened. This is something that happens, that there is not enough attention from law enforcement in, like, there's not enough effort to solve it. So it's going to keep happening. It's been happening since the beginning of time as like a war tool, right? And as long as, you know, we have these higher forces at play, it's going to keep happening. So yeah, I just think absolving yourself of that shame first, before you go tell people. Although I will say, for me, it was really helpful to start small and tell friends, and just have them say over and over to me, like, it's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. There's always like a bit of a risk there, because what if someone responds and says, oh, maybe it is your fault.
Yeah.
But I think we have instincts as humans about who will respond that way and who wouldn't. So,
Yeah. Start small. That's great advice.
Yeah.
Kaylee, this has been a very enlightening conversation.
Right? It was so great to talk to you. You're so awesome. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming. Tell us where we can find you.
You can get my book on anywhere books are sold. If you go into a bookstore or whatever, you can ask for it. Unreported by Kaylee Roberts. It's also on Amazon. If we're doing that, although we don't love Amazon, but you know, you can get it there really easy. I can send you a link. And then, yeah, I'm on Instagram, Kale Chips and Dip. I know it should be more professional than that.
Oh my gosh. That's, what is it? Kale Chips and Dip?
Kale Chips, letter N, Dip. So Kale Chips and Dip. I'm so attached to it. I want to change it, but I can't.
whatever works, whatever, it's memorable, that's for sure. Are you working on anything currently?
Yeah. So, well, I'm actually, for my day job, I work on documentary film. So it's just storytelling in a different way. And yeah, I love it. And we have a documentary coming out on Netflix in the fall. So right now I don't have much time to write beyond that. But I've got some ideas cooking for the next book. So yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll look out for your next project, Kaylee.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Although the content of our conversation was quite heavy and carried a lot of gravitas, talking with Kaylee was a delight because she has so much passion about her message and her purpose, and that passion just infuses everything that she does. So if you want to read her book, then I highly recommend that you visit the link in the show notes to her page on Amazon, and visit her Instagram to find out more about her, because she has a wealth of experience and knowledge and information from all the research she's done from personal experience about this heavy topic of sexual assault. And if you've been sexually assaulted, then talk to someone that you know and trust and share your story, because there's so much power in just sharing the story with people who have earned your trust. So thank you so much for tuning into this episode. After you visit Kaylee's links, visit vzazo.com and sign up for my newsletter, and you can follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter at Ebony Haywood, and I'm on Instagram and Facebook at Motivation to Write. And I will see you next week when I talk to another fabulous guest. Okay, bye-bye.